knew exactly what to do because I practiced it in the house with her and this other guy. I'm looking like a baby-faced kid looking around at the jewelry and all that. And I could see she's like thinking about, I'm a young lad falling in love with his girlfriend and he's going to buy this diamond ring for her. And she's looking at me, and I said, it's very expensive. I said, I know, yeah. And I started talking to her. And as I put the ring back in, my little finger went over that one there. Big bar over the window, boom. The glass is going in with the jewellery. I said, Joey, come on, you're getting a bit greedy. As we're just pulling away, this cop had runs in front of the car, couldn't kill him, couldn't run over him, could I? What had he done? He had like a mascot on the front, Jaguar on it, he grabbed that. As I'm backing up like that, screaming the car, he's still on it, he won't f***ing get off.
Welcome back for Charlie Seeger, Old School Liverpool Gangster podcast number 2. If you watched the last one, it only went up a few days ago. It's getting 10,000 views a day. People all over Liverpool, the Northwest in particular, talking about it. We're inundated with people getting Charlie's book. And I'd like to announce we've also added now that Charlie's book can be purchased signed copies with dedications in them. And we're adding a link below the video in the description box for those as well. We left off in part one with Charlie safe blowing back in 1957. This was a big thing for him and his crew back then. They introduced this. Charlie was just a kid. And the safe, the last story was they were testing the safe blowing. The safe went, and it just missed one of their mates who took a pee. And he was walking across and it just skimmed his head.
That was the door blown off.
The door. Wow.
You went, if the door went right up in the sky.
Would have took his head off though, wouldn't it?
It did, yeah. It didn't know, sorry.
It would have.
yeah. So that's it. This is the safe.
Yeah, so that was what, about 1957, was it?
That was the first time we tried it out. And we done it again and it became successful. So we became blowing safes up and down the country. And we started off in our own town first, at different places. But with the noise of the safe, the bangs it was making, we had to be very careful because when it did go off, it was like a bomb going off and it could be heard by the police. You know what I mean? Because they were always on foot patrols and all that. So I come up with a bit of an idea like that. When we get in these places, we'll try and pack the safe with stuff to try and deaden the sound. But it wasn't much of an effect. It still made a noise, you know. So we started targeting these big establishments, these big businesses. And in that time, in 57, laundries were big, massive businesses taking thousands and loads of money, laundries. Nobody had washing machines then. It wasn't even invented, the washing machine then. And we targeted laundries. And believe it or not, whatever the public was in demand with, like cinemas, well, that came later on. But it was mostly laundries and swimming baths, because they were chock-a-block. But again, the noises was bringing the police in quick. So we had to be on the alert all the time. So anyway, come up with the idea about picture houses. They're called cinemas now. And if you go inside a picture house and you hear a big war film going off, bombs going, you can't hear it outside. So that was it. We started it in cinemas all over the place. And it was successful. But then again, I started going the other way because it was dangerous as well. The police were getting alert with it all now and everything. See, when the criminal comes out with, like, say, an invention, he's invented how to blow a safe. I know it sounds stupid in layman's terms, but say he's done that, other criminals start jumping on the bandwagon as well. because the Oates had mates around the city. The Oates brothers, what were doing it with us in a big way. And then you got another firm, what was introduced to us. Because we weren't greedy, we're all letting people have a piece of the cake. So you got firms coming up to us and asking how it's done. You know what I mean? I wasn't charging them, by the way, to show them how to blow it. Just explaining. Only joking. And you got the Cannon brothers. I don't know whether they'll be dead now, but the families will still be alive. The Cannon brothers, Bertie Cameron, Cannon. And then you got Charlie Rawlinson. He was from the Wavertree area, his gang, with Dickie Jones. I think Dickie Jones, what a man Dickie Jones was. These people were real men, you know what I mean? Great people. There was no greediness amongst them, you know, robbing off one another and all that. There was loyalties. Loyalties were the main thing there, and principles. And so everybody was blowing safes in no time. So obviously, all around the city and on the outskirts, it was getting, the police were going mad. They were just going mad. But I remember we did one in just outside, and this can be verified, it'll be in the papers anyway, even from that time. The safes, we tried one out in these baths in St. Helens. That's a little village, a little town outside Liverpool. We thought we'd start going further afield, you know. And we blew the safe in the swimming baths. They were taking loads of money in, day and night. And it had in the paper, big bang at the baths. You know what I mean? So it was coming to that way where we had to be really, really careful, you know, what we picked. Mind you, we could choose and pick our work. But I started going on information then. Information was the main thing in my criminality. If you got good information off the right, some of them tell lies. But if you got good information, like, and a fellow gives you the right information, he's going to be on a good cut. You know, he'll be out the way, and whatever we do, he gets it. So we got taken to, we heard about this place in Wales, Wrexham Steam Laundry. I thought laundries were doing like hospital laundries, factory laundries, all the washing, houses. Nobody has washing machines them days. They weren't even invented them days, the washing machines. So we started to target like laundries, big laundries. Anyway, we put onto this one over in Wales. I'd never been to Wales in my life. But, you know, further afield. And it was called the Wrexham Steam Laundry. It was in the centre of town. So this guy would put the information on. He was a driver for the laundries, and he knew somebody, we knew somebody. And it was bang on. The money was in the safe on the Sunday night, everything. And everything got banked on the Monday morning. It was emptied out, taken to the banks. This safe had a load of money in it. Big, very, all North Wales was going to this place. So we kicked off, we went over on the Sunday night. We'd been over before to look at it in the daytime, weighing it up, you know, case, what you call casing the joint, you know what I mean? Seeing how it's worked and what's the best route in case there's a chase or whatever. This is what I always done, you say, made sure our safety was okay, you know what I mean? We didn't want to jeopardise our freedom or nothing like that. So anyway, we goes over on this Sunday night, and a fella from Kirby who joined up with the firm called Burns, Tony Burns, I think he's there. He's one of the old school, the old town. We went over to Wrexham. And now Wrexham them days was like just a small little town. Not like they all are now, all messed up and everything. We get over there about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the night. Dead simple to get in. They even had the windows open in the place. Big, like, windows, you know. They always had big windows and laundries. Dead simple to get into the place. No, there was no breaking in the door. We got into the window, got it. And don't forget, the tools we were carrying was only, like, you could have it in your pockets. So, like, there was no carrying all kinds of stuff inside and all. We get in this place, set it up. I said, this is great, this, because we can pack all the laundry gear on there, all the clothes on the safe, dead in the sound. So he gets about there, setting her off and all that, getting her sorted. Puts the gel igniter in, gets the detonator in. Now, don't forget, we've been doing safe, so we know the score now and everything. But sometimes you'd have some mishaps. Some little things can go wrong, you know what I mean? So sets it all up. Everything's okay. It's about 12 o'clock, 11 o'clock, half 11, something like that, 12 o'clock. Lights the fuse, gets back into a doorway out the way where this safe was. And it went bang. Wasn't so much of a thud, but it was still loud, bang. Because you've got to go straight in and get what you can out of it and get out the way. Because if the police have heard it, you're finished. So we get to it. And the safe didn't. This is the only time a safe never opened for me.
No.
I must have didn't put quite enough jelly in it, you know. So I said, look, you know the golden rule. We can't carry on with this. But this Tony fella wouldn't have it. He said, look, we've come all the way over here. There's loads of readies and that. You know what I mean? We've done it all right and everything. They're trying it again. I said, but making a mistake. I said, I know it. Look, the coppers will have heard this. Now it'll be all right. So I said to our Freddy, what do you think? He said, no, well, you're right. Yeah. I said, look, kid. I said, look, you know, we're not skins. Let's face it. Did we have to jeopardise anything? So we took a bit of a vote, like so. I said, all right, I'll have to be quick. Started setting her up again. As I was setting her up, just ready to go, all lights come on the windows. We were surrounded by the police. I think it was the old Welsh police force come from all over the place. They had searchlights on the windows and everything. Come out, lads. Come out, lads. The game's up and all this, like, you know, fair cop, they say, them days, don't they? Come out, lads. Well, it was up. There was no escape for us. We had to sort of give ourselves up. There was just no way you could get away. And the little van, what he had, drove us over there. It was parked out the way, so we were finished. So we walked out, and this was unbelievable what happened. We were handcuffed. And we were marched down a Welsh street, this like big street, towards the police station where they'd lock it up. And for some reason or other, people were coming out of their houses, looking at all these men getting walking in a line, handcuffed, 2 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, with the police guarding you down there. And they were all like, it was like as if we were like celebrities or something. They were all out, they couldn't believe it. This had happened in Wales. Nothing like that had ever happened in Wales before. Not that severe or, you know. So we're marching down into the police station. If you get nicked in Liverpool and the police get you and you get taken to a police station in them days, you can be expecting a bit of an iron off them if you're not going to say anything or admit to anything. But we had no choice here. We may as well tell the fucking truth. We'd caught bang to right, so you may as well tell the truth. What's the use of trying to deny it? My brain was working overtime here as well. You know what I mean? I was only a 17-year-old kid. So when we got in the police station, couldn't believe it, the way the police treated us. Come on now, lads, they said. Yeah. Took the handcuffs off us. Give us a cell each. And this copper said, yeah, he's only a lad. Give him that nice blanket there. And big hot drinks, you know, hot cocoa, they also give you that. And, you know, they looked after us great. You know, we were like, couldn't believe it. And we were all in a different cell because obviously they're going to question you. But they didn't have to worry about us because we were going to throw our arms up to it, you know what I mean? We're going to say, well, fair cop, they say, don't they? You know what I mean? But whilst we were in that police custody, waiting for the court, I mean, don't forget it was Sunday night, the police from Liverpool were right over. From Liverpool, somewhere in Widnes, St. Helen, different coppers were coming over to interview us. And they were, obviously, we'd done some of the things, but they were coming over to see us. And one of them tried to become the hard tactics with us. And the Welsh police said, aye, they're our prisoners. You don't lay a finger on them. They're with us. What you do over there, you do over there. You're not going to touch these here. And the copper said, you don't know who they are. You know, they were arguing. And they fucked. the police off out the way, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we were left in charge of the bus. Isn't it great, great when you're in charge of coppers and they're looking after you? So anyway, we goes to court and we gets remanded. I'd never been into a prison in my life before. So we gets remanded in prison, on remand, only for a week till we go to court again. So we're on remand in prison. And obviously, before we went there, me old fella come over with one of the neighbours and their people come over to see us and make sure we were okay and we had everything. But we went into prison and I'd never been in prison in my life. I was only a kid and we were on remand. And you'd have what you call the remand wings for young offenders, but then that wing in Bolton was for everybody, young and old, when you're on remand. Now they have it like, he goes here and he goes there. You were all thrown in together. So while we were in prison, I met a few people in there. When they knew what we were in for, they couldn't believe it. And there was a lot of Cockneys in there who come over. A fella called Eric Mason. He was a well-known gangster in London years ago. He was talking to me in different ones, you know. So anyway, talking away and all that. And we made up a story then. And the story was this. I invented it as well. Because, you know, these when they're getting on a bit, they don't realise what they're doing. I said, look, if we're pleading guilty, obviously they go a bit more lenient on you. But I'm pleading guilty as well. But what I need you two to say when we're in the dock or make a statement, you've got to make the statements when you're pleading guilty, that I had nothing to do with the safe blowing. I'm only young, 17. And if I get released, then I look after you and your family when you're in. For that is, you know, the scored kid. He said, yeah, I know that, Charlie. Yeah. I said, so I'm going to be the innocent kid taken along just to keep a lookout for you while you've done the actual safe blowing. It was me who organised it. I was the organiser. All right, we'll go down, we'll give that in. So this is what happened. So cut a long story. A few weeks go by and we're going into the High Court. We've been remanded, no bail. Oh, yeah, sorry, I got bail. And a dummy thing, you like, I was only 17, but I still had to go to court with them, the High Court. So I relayed it, when I was on bail, I relayed it to our kid's wife and this other fella and that, you know, you'll be looked after, not everything's going to be all right. So anyway, when we went to court, a judge called Justice Castles, still remember his name, 1957, and he said, he was in court, and our lawyers were saying about, look, they pleaded guilty, they've caught banks of rights for, if you can just go a bit lenient on them and all this, well, they don't, do they? I mean, this is a big, serious, one of the highest charges in the land, using explosives. And then they always had things on, don't they, the prosecuting. Somebody could have been killed. Who's going to be killed at 3 o'clock in the morning when they're all in bed? You know what I mean? But they always come out with all this thing. So you get a big sentence. So what happened? They sentenced our Freddie to 3 years. And to the other guy, his mate, he got 3 years. And then they brought me back up. So the judge, my lawyer, great lawyer he was giving it his all, you know what I mean? He was trying to defend me really good, like, you know, he's giving it everything. Kept insisting about my youth and all this, and I've never been in trouble before, which he hadn't been. And the judge said, yes, I'm quite aware your client is youth. You keep emphasising on this all the time. And I know he hasn't been in trouble before and all this, but how do I know that he's been contaminated by them, influenced by them for what they've done? He said, well, sir, and he keeps trying his best. He said, and we were told this later on by our lawyer that the judge's wife was in the gallery with his daughter, up on the gallery. But the court was packed, you know. This has never been heard of in Wales. It was just chock-a-block, you know what I mean, chock-a-block. So the next minute, the judge is like that, looking at me, and he said, I don't know whether I'm taking a chance with this young man. He said, how do I know? He's like a young lion what's tasted his first blood. How do I know he's not going to do it again? I know he's only 17, but we might have been corrupted already. And then he went quiet. And I think, because his wife was in the court and his daughter, which we were told, like, that lawyers, well, it was true, this, and this can be verified if they go back in time and check it out. He looked up at, I seen him sort of like glance quickly up at the gallery and back it down again. Now, I don't know whether his wife might have gone, oh no, or his daughter might have gone like that to him. I don't know. It could have happened. But he said, right, he said, I'm going to take a chance with you, young man. Yes, I'm quite aware that you've been out of trouble, he said. But when you leave this court, you'll be going put on probation for 2 years, he said. And I'm giving you good advice here, he said. You go out and lead an honest life. You've got a clean record. You're only young. You're only a young boy, he said, 17 years of age. Little did he realise this young boy was the instigator who set all this up. So I thanked him, said, thank you, you know, like that. And so, like, I was free. I said, and as I walked out of the court and everything, I went out and I was thinking about that judge said, he's given me a chance in life, which was great. Like, people said they haven't had chances. That's a good chance to give you. And it was a good chance, you know what I mean? And I thought, that means I've got to go to work like the rest of them, working on building sites or whatever they're doing in the cold. And I know that's not the life for me. And I thought, I can't do that. That's no life for me. I'm too involved in that. This is the life I want. I really enjoy what I'm doing. I said, it's given me a good life. So after the judge was ringing in my ears, all that, what he said, going out and lead a decent life. 6 weeks later, I was out blowing safes again. Kicked out blowing safe. But it was coming to an end. It was the end of the line. People were getting caught, getting set up, you know, fixed up. I mean, the Cannon Brothers were having a go at it now. Different firms are getting on it. And don't forget, it's getting to the end of the 50s, you know. Safe blowing completely came out of fashion around about 1959, 60, went right down. And there was other ways of making money. But after that, while I was on probation, I moved back with my own mates, my own little firm, and some had joined up. I always kept in touch with my mates and give them a few quid and advice and all that. And they were my own age, and I went back with them. Got my mates, and another fella, Joey Doyle, jumped in with me. He's one of my best mates. He was my mates for years and years, this lad. They were all good mates of mine, you know what I mean? But Joey, what a man he was. I mean, don't forget, they were all living in poverty. And we were young lads what wanted a bit of excitement. Not excitement, they wanted a life, you know what I mean? The only way you could get it is trying to rob a few quid off these people that's got it, rich people. So Joey jumped in with us. And what a time we had. We were against all kinds. And then I remember Joey Hannigan. There was two Joeys in the firm. Joey said to me, come round, said, Charlie, he said, I'm decking out now, he said, I'm joining the Merchant Navy. And little Yatesy went to be a bricklayer. And they all went honest, which is good. They chose that way of life. And funny enough, that way of life, what they chose, you know, bricklaying and all that, years and years and years later, when we were in our 40s or 50s, I bumped into a few of them. And they looked like old men. The elements of the out in the cold building and on the cars, trying to fix a car and all that, it caught up with them. You know what I mean? And they used to be drinking in the local pub then and settle down with wives and kids. Well, you know, that wasn't the life for me. You know, I wanted to live good.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast. This is with my sponsor, NordVPN. As many of you know, I am inundated with links from hackers and cyber bandits trying to steal my channel. I've lost it twice, actually. But now with NordVPN, with just one click, I am safe. There are so many attacks out there that Nord protects you from, half of which I've never even heard of before. You got the man-in-the-middle attack. You're at a cafe. You think you're using the free Wi-Fi. Boom! They steal your sensitive data. You've got phishing. You've got password attacks. You've got DDoS. Yes, I got one of them. They tried to shut down my live stream. We've got malware. We've got malvertising. We've got ransomware. And also, if you want to watch something overseas, my documentary of Sammy the Bull is coming out in January in America. Guess where my VPN will be set at? There's nothing worse than a VPN that slows you down, but NordVPN is the fastest VPN out there. You can get an exclusive NordVPN deal plus 4 months extra here at my link, /NordVPN.com/Atwood. It's risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Link is in the description box if you're watching on YouTube. Again, it's /NordVPN.com/Atwood. Cheers.
I remember the first holiday I had after all that was years in them days. There was no such a thing as jets, you know. Jets weren't flying over to Spain and not like that in the 50s. Not like that. The only holidays people had in them days was in England, Torquay. Torquay was like, it was like paradise, Torquay. It's like, it was like, oh, it's beautiful. Blue water and everything, and the Isle of Man. And we had a touch, me and Joey, and the touch was, is, I don't want to be getting mixed up here with the times and that, but what it was, I went back to see Winnie. Remember Winnie, what I told you in the modern day Fagin? Went back to see her to see how she was going on. And I said she was going to be my mentor on the last one. Well, she became my mentor. And I went to see Winnie. And she was still the same, but she's got a boyfriend now, this fella, other fella, what was it? He looked like a spiff, you know, with a blocker on and all that, tie and suit on and all that. And you could see he was at a ponce, really, you know, ponce nuffer. Little thin pencil men's pencil moustache, you know, them horrible people. And mind you, the same fella was a good information fella. He got good information. And he come out with some good information. And Winnie said to me, look, Charlie, she said, what about robbing some jewellers? You know, you've done all the safe. What about going? She could see the potential in me. I said, what do you mean? She said, jewellery shops are magnetic in Liverpool, all over Liverpool. Fair shops, big shops, fair coats and everything. That was all big business. But jewellery shops, she said, I'll show you something here, she said. How to rob these rings from jewellers, right under the noses. Couldn't believe it. So she showed me. And what it was, with me being young looking, even though I was only 17, I could get away with being a bit younger, really. I don't know about now. I mean, I'm 85 now. I don't know how I'll look now. Like, but
look good, man. Them, like 50?
But in them days, we were only baby-faced kids. So, like, she said, she dressed me up. Because our Billy was at Borden, he won a scholarship. And he used to go to school with his badge on. You know, the boy's badge on and all that. And she dressed me up in a blazer with this fella. This fella knew how to manipulate things and everything. Ooh, he was brilliant. But he was a ponce. He wouldn't rob nothing himself, but he used to come up with some great information. And then they showed me, and we practiced there in Winnie's house. All the shoplifting like with the young kids now had all disappeared now. She was getting herself on top. So the next minute, he showed me a carton of rings. And in the carton, he'd have rings in it. You know, the velvet on the rings with the rings. You've seen them in jewellery shops. Well, he said, Anna, when you go into the jewellers, you're going to be dressed like, you know, and it's, you're working in an office in town. You're an office worker. You come out because you look the part, she said. You know what I mean? You know, your appearance will go a long way here. She said, And if you go in then with your baby face and make out that you're saving up for an engagement ring for your girlfriend who's in the same office, she said, and you go into a jeweler's, when you go in, always try and pick a lady who's to serve you instead of a man. Always go for the lady. And go in with the... So I was good at fronting up, you know what I mean? I could front anything up. So anyway, cut a long story short. The first jewelers, when he waited outside down the road, in pure day like this, in Liverpool, think of it now. Walked in, loads of people around then, you know, hustling, bustling, all that. And I walked into this jeweler's. I knew exactly what to do because I practiced it in the house where Aaron and this other guy. So the next minute, when I gets in there, I'm looking like a baby-faced kid looking around at the jewelry and all that. I was looking in the windows first, and I could see that there was women, two women in there and a couple of men. So try and get that woman, you know. Goes in. And as I walked in, this lady, yes, can I help you? I said, yes. I said, I'm thinking of getting engaged to my girlfriend. I want to buy a ring. But I know I'll have to save up for it, I think. You know, I know they're expensive, but could I pick one out, what I think she'd like, please? And when I come in with that chat, you know what I mean? And I had like a college tie on me. And when I went to that, I seen her whispering to another girl, and she went and got a thing. She said, have you got it? I said, well, I seen one in the window there. And they always told me, when he always pick a ring with some of the rings out of the pad missing. So I showed her the one, you know, she brought it in. And in them days, you know, people trusted you, you know, this has never, don't forget, this has never been done before. Again, me again. So she put the pad on the thing like that. And I'm looking at them like that, like the pad. And she's across the thing in front of her eyes. And I could see she's like thinking about, I'm a young lad falling in love with his girlfriend and he's going to buy this diamond ring for her, you know. And I'm looking up, she said, they are very expensive, you know. I said, no, but they are beautiful, aren't they? I said, you know, and you could pick the tray up and look at them. So what I'd done is I picked it up and looked at them like that. And she's looking at me. And she must be saying, oh, you can't afford that. Put the tray down back on the counter. And then I picked the ring out of the tray. I said, that one would be lovely. And she's looking at me. I said, it's very expensive. I said, I know, yeah. And I started talking to her. And as I put the ring back in, my little finger went over that one there. And I give her the tray back like that. And I had that ring. I said, okay, I'll have to think about it. Okay, son, she said, go on, off you go. And I walked out with a fucking ring with a couple of grand. Walked out with a ring. You pick the ring up like that. Just pick it up. Look at it. As I'm putting it back, that little finger went... I practiced on it. We practiced for weeks on it. You know what I mean? So jewelry's were business then. So I got Joey, and a couple of me mates. It was all over the papers, by the way, this. Young office boys going into Liverpool, into jewelry shops, trying to steal rings. Police are going mad and all that. So it's only a matter of time before it comes on top. So I've done another one. Oh, no, I didn't, sorry. That was the last one. Then I thought, what's stopping me from fucking snatching one? You know what I mean? Pick a right one out and snatch it. So we got Joey, he was on a bike down an alleyway, by the shop, down an alleyway. My other mate, Kenny, was that way, keeping a lookout. I was going to run to Kenny when I could run out of the shop with it, give the ring, the pad to Kenny, he walk away and just give Joey the thing he needs, pedal away on his bike. And I just get the tram home, the tram cars then, in Liverpool in the city. So anyway, he goes into this place, looking at it. I'm weighing it up, could see it was easy. So I'm looking at it all. And there's the rings, and I've done the same thing again. Could you show me that ring, path out of the window, with the ring on? I know he's outside me, mate. Just in case anything happens, he could stop somebody. And I waited for the right moment, and I looked at it like that. I was looking over it, didn't even pick her up, I was looking at it like that. She's behind that wide counter like that. The other staff the day. People were walking in and out. And all of a sudden, I seen the door just ajar like that, and I just went, it's now or never. My heart was pounding away. Grabbed it quick. Out the door fast, shut the door behind me, run like fuck. Passed it to me mate. He passed it on to the other one. Me and him then jumped on the car. And the car is absolutely passing the jewellers, what was on the corner, the tram car, we're on the top seats like that. And there's all commotion going outside. I could see a fella scratching his head going like that. And they were pointing different ways. The police were there and we were just going home in the car. That fucking thing was worth a fortune. Winnie and this fella were selling it all for us, you know what I mean? So that's what we started doing. We started progressing with our work. So after that, I said, Joey, let's have a blow eye. He said, what's the matter? I said, nobody's ever thought of holidays at that time, 57. Nobody ever thought, only the rich people went, don't they? The working class people didn't. New Brighton he went to with a bucket and a sand and all that, like parcel of sarnies, you know. So I wanted an holiday, mate. So I said, listen, Joe, I said, let's go on a nice holiday. I said, we've got the dough here. All right, Charlie. Yeah. What about the Isle of Man? Because my brothers were in the Mates and they all used to do, some of their friends used to do on the Isle of Man boats, going to the Isle, and they used to say it was lovely, lovely island, you know. Lovely place to go to, untouched. I said, oh. So I said to Joey, shall we go to the Isle of Man? So we went down to the Pearhead, got on the boat. It's a 4-hour trip. Brilliant to watch, you know. We thought we were great, like the tubers going over there. Gets over there, oh, what a place. It was to us, it was like, the hotels were all posh then, all rich people in them, you know what I mean? Me and Joey were walking around like two little millionaires. Anyway, it was a sad time for me, really. It was a good holiday, but something happened really sad in my life. And it's a thing that I'll carry for the rest of my life, what really happened to me. So when we're having this lovely holiday there, we stayed there for a week. I met a girl over there. And she became my real, true girlfriend. Because I'd been with other girls in Liverpool. It was only like a kiss in the entry and whatever, you know. But this was a clean, lovely-looking girl. A bit posh-like, but she was nice. And her name was Joyce Valanti. And it's still, this story will still be in the Manx Museum or the papers from way back, 1957. And her name was Joyce Valanti. The reason why her name was Valanti, that was her dad's name, he was Italian. But he was a prisoner of war and he had Italian prisoners of war then. And her mother was from the Isle of Man herself and she married him. But then when he went back to Italy, she was pregnant and she had the baby and she married another fellow called Braley. So that name, she was either Joyce Braley or Valanti, but she preferred to be called Valanti. Anyway, we used to walk down the beach and be holding hands now. It's funny, isn't it, when you talk like this, really, than things what you've been through. When you meet your first true love, when you're a young kid, I don't think you could ever get that feeling again, that magic feeling what God's given you. Do you know what I mean? Beautiful feeling. You just think of it every day and every minute. Nothing else could. I didn't even think of stealing or robbing. I was just concentrating on her. I thought, I absolutely madly in love with her, and she was with me. And her parents, she introduced me to her parents. I mean, Joey took a back seat. He was knocking around the Isle of Man for a bit. He still with me, like, but he was taking a back seat. So she introduced me to her parents, and they were lovely people, you know. And obviously, they wanted to know my background, and they just thought I was an hard, honest, working lad from Liverpool who'd come on his first holiday. You know what I mean? So I was accepted by the family. So like little did they know what I was like, God help, you know. But what happened, when I got back to Liverpool, we were writing to one another, because there was none of these little phones then. You wrote letters then, you know, and sent little cards to one another, little love letters and all that. And I was planning to go back over to see her in a couple of months' time. And she said she was going to South Africa with her mum and her parents over I think they had relatives over in South Africa. And she went to South Africa for a couple of weeks or something. But I got a letter through the post. Everybody got letters, and not phone calls, letters. It was from a friend in the Isle of Man called Audrey, I forget her second name. And when I opened the letter, it just broke me. She'd been killed by a train. The first day she got to South Africa, on a train killed her on a, where she was, getting on a train or getting up again, killed, fell over and killed. 17 years of age, she lost her life. She was in all the papers. I was just devastated. I never got over that. And, you know, life goes on, doesn't it? And you've got to forget it. I did eventually for me, but at the time I was walking around Liverpool, just broken hearted, you know what I mean? Couldn't get over it. It was killed me. Because I'd never had that feeling with a girl before. And funny enough, having said that, I've been with lots of women through my life. We all have, I think. You know, they've come and gone with me and all that. But I don't think you'd ever capture that first true love what you get. That's the first thing you get. You fall in love again, but you fall out of love and you fall in love. But that was my first true love, and she got killed. And it was just so sad to me that, you know what I mean? Really broke me up a little bit. But anyway, I had to return back to my way of life then in the end. And I went bang at it again, you know what I mean? Can we have a blow now for a minute?
Yeah, of course.
Oh. Sitting in this chair a long time.
Gets your shoulders, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh. Do you do press-ups? Do you do any working out?
Yeah, go to gym, do the bench presses, squats,
can
pull-ups.
Can you bend down and touch your toes?
Yeah, I can do all that, yeah.
Oh, well, that's all.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Some people can't tie their own shoelaces.
I know.
How old are you now?
56.
Well, that's good if you can do that at your age.
Yeah.
I'm doing it now at my age.
Yeah. Wow. You're my inspiration then.
Is it all right to go now, mate?
Yeah, it's just going all the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
I finally got over my grief. I didn't get over it, but you've got to, life goes on, doesn't it?
Yep.
And I got me here together with Joey, another mate of mine, John Connor. These are all up-and-coming kids now in the late teens. You know, we were all getting on to nearly 18 now, 17, 18. And just before I entered the other lag, which was heavy, bit heavy stuff, I was still concentrating on Winnie, the work what she had for me. That jewel is what I was talking about. Then he put me onto another one in Liverpool. I made a lot of money in Liverpool in the daytime, the jobs I was pulling up. And this one was like one of these big offices, you know, where people are in offices typing and all that. And this guy gave us the information. He said, every Friday morning, if you go into his office, on the desk, all the money's laid out in mungles, comes from different firms. He's got to sort all this money out in this office, where all these office workers are. Big staircase going up, all the big buildings, Liverpool, all offices and everything, big firms, big companies. He went up these big staircases, big posh, you know, they were all posh places. Worked along different corridors, this office, that office. So he showed me this guy, took me down there, Winnie's boyfriend, or partner, whatever he was. And he said, what it is, the money gets laid out on a Friday. I said, well, I want to go and see this first. You know, people tell you lies and tell it's there and it's not when you're going to do it. Do you know what I mean? So I had to go, I always started going over work, what I've been, any information what I was given. It could take me weeks to plan a play thing out. I'd go over it, make sure everything was accurate and it was in place. So I went down to this office with Joey. I said, and we had to be smartly dressed. You can't just go down there in our jeans and hood on your face and all that. So we had to look the part a bit, you know. So we're in this office and goes down. I said, yeah, Joe, this is the one here, what he showed me. And then it was on a Friday as well. Go in. And the guy was in there, didn't see the money on the counter where he said it was, on the desk. But I seen something what caught my eye. There was a young office girl in there what went in with a bag of something, put it on the thingy. And as she went in there, this fella what was in there, a typical You could see what he was. Like, he thought he was a ladies man, one of them fellas, you know. Liked the women, but what an ugly man he was, you know what I mean? One of them fellas with the collar and tie on and trying to look the part, you know. And a young girl, 16-year-old girl or something, my age, goes in to give him this. And then as she's doing something, I seen him touch her ass or something. Went to grab her and she smacked his hand away. And she went, you know, come out with a bit of a face. And I'm just like, by the way, I'm just walking up and down, seeing this happen. You know, because he literally grabbed her ass and she smacked him. So the week later, I went in, the next Friday. Said, Joey, it might be here this time. Goes next week. Down to the thing, Joey comes with me. By the way, we're office lads messing about. As we get to the thingy, the windows in the office, I seen the money on the counter and I'm counting it. I said, Joe, there it is now. I'm going to have it now. It's got to go. All right. We planned this out, like, what we were going to do. I said, Joe, you get ready. When I come running out of that office, you fucking make out that, what's going on? Stop somebody. You know what I mean? You've got no record. All right. I'm going, all right, yeah. So I goes into the office. Oh, you wouldn't believe what I'd done to get this money. He sent me on the desk there. Goes in, shuts the door. No, only a minute. There's the fucking dough on the thingy. That's what I've got my eyes on. I was like that. He went to him, yes, can I help you? I said, yes, you can, actually. I said, my girlfriend came in here last week to see you over something. She works in the office just down there. I said, and she told me that you tried to touch her up, grabbing her ass at the, and all that. No, I did not. You bloody did, I said. No, I didn't, she said. I said, well, she's told me that as soon. She's not lying. I think you're a bloody dirty old man, you know, because he must have been about 30 odd then, you know what I mean? I'm only a kid. So he goes, I don't know where you're getting this from. So I leaned over the office desk like that, put my hands on it, right over face to face with him, and I smacked him right hard across the face, bang. And he went out and said, oh, I'm sorry, I said. I'm sorry for hitting you, I said. Oh, and he said, you little bastard, he said. And he come running around after me. And he chased me down the road like that. And as he's chasing me like mad, Joey's right in the cops. Joey's right in the cops of money. So he give up on the chase. So as he's coming back, Joey's passing in with the fucking dough. And he doesn't know. And we both fucked up. And we got a nice few quid out of it. Went back to Winnie's, you know. Winnie counting money and all that, you know. Still a pagan, like. So this was going on. This is the sort of work we were doing. But one day, one of my mates come around. He said, have you seen what's going on at the top of our road there, where Winnie lived? I said, no. All the old little kids were, she must have had them as shoplifters, you know. That was their little gang. They were all outside, you know, some of them and all that. Big police, Black Mariah outside. Poor Winnie's getting marched in, and her boyfriend. And I'm looking below, looking at her like that, sad across the road, me and my mates. Just think we were like that, with them kids were there. I said, a sad ending for Winnie, you know what I mean? I don't know whatever happened to her. She must have went to jail or something. I mean, she'd be well dead now. She was years older than me, but God bless you, Winnie, wherever you are, love. Maybe up in heaven. Yeah, so that was the end of Winnie. That was coming to the end of Winnie.
So, Charlie, by 1958 then, you was 18. How did that year unfold?
Well, I was starting to grow up a lot then, 1958. People were moving on with crime. Crime rises and it gets advanced and the police get advanced with things as well. I said, but I remember when I was a kid first, when I was about, go back when I was about 12 or 13. And we're doing things on bikes, we were running around on bicycles. But I wanted a bit more than that, even though I was a kid. Now I'd seen the tractors on the farms and we'd had a little go at that. You know, and the gearbox on a tractor was like an H, first gear, second gear and all that. Like. And we wanted to get a car. We were sitting in this place, the crowd was on the field. We used to go on our back field when we were kids and discuss where we're going to plan a robbery out. So we were there on the backfield, and I said, one of us, and he said, I want to learn to drive, get a car. Because somebody needs, might, in the future, the car might be the best for us, you know what I mean? We're going down on bikes here and running away on feet, foot. People are starting to drive. So how did we get a car, Charlie, and all that? So we shut down, we went down into town. And believe it or not, all cars, what were parked outside, there's no parking meters then, or double yellow lines. Cars were parked outside offices and factories and whatever. And the cars were open. They weren't locked. They were sports cars, you know, with the hoods off and everything. And so we're walking down the street. I think it was Old Hall Street, where the Echo office is now, coming up Old Hall Street. I said, that's ideal, that car, Joe, look at that one there. It was an Austin, an old Austin diesel. Do you know, in them days, there was no foreign cars in England, you know. There was all Austins. Obviously, you had the Fords, Jaguars, Triumphs, MGBs. They were all English cars. Because when cars first come over, the Chinese cars and all them, the foreign cars, we were amazed at it. You'd see a car come over with plastic bumpers. We always had the big chrome bumpers and we used to polish them. You know, with the car. They were our main things, you know. But when you've seen all this rubbish, it's just future, isn't it, the way things change. But anyway, we're down there looking at this Austin. I'm saying an old Austin now. It was practically brand new then. And I said, Joey, we can have that one away. And some people had left the keys in cars. The apps, honest to God, you wouldn't believe this, but that did happen. Or they put the keys on the visor, you know, the blind, some blind thing. But anyway, this Austin was there, and I fancied it, you know. It's just a nice car, a nice little car. I said, Joe, I think I'll be able to drive that, you know, because on the tractor, you see the gear stick and all that. I said, it's got the same stick and all that, brakes and pedals. He said, you think, Charles? So he gets in the car with me, and we've got a little screwdriver. Just banged it in like that, and I turned over, boom, boom. I couldn't even reverse. I didn't know how to put it into reverse. So it gets in it. Now, don't forget, I'm only a kid here, 13, you know what I mean? So I starts driving it down the road, gets onto the main drag, and I'm in second gear. I can't even change it into another gear. And it gets all the way fucking up to Whiting, and it conks out on us. It conks out. But we blew the engine up, and we just left it there and run away. So I didn't give up. We went back down again a couple of weeks later. So I'm going to have another go, you know, thinking all that. Got another motor there, down there. I think it was a Ford Prefect, a new one, but just come out. Anyway, drives up, and there was a big farm field up our way where we all used to play football and that when we were kids, out the way. Nobody bothered you there or nothing. Nobody went near it. Even the farmers abandoned it, I think. Just a big empty field. Anyway, we get this one, and I started driving it properly a bit. Finally gets up to the big farm, just outside Liverpool it was. About 3 miles outside. And as it drives, the car is thinking, me other mates are waiting for us on bikes. They know we're coming up. So I get in this car. And I drove that car, honest to God, for fucking like 2 hours, non-stop. Just going round and round, getting the fucking thingies. And Yates and the others went to the garage. You could get petrol out of a garage then. Down to the garage and come back with it just in case, filled that up. I'm driving around, having a blow. She said, Charlie, fucking hell, it's going great. Can I have a go? Yeah, I said, no, you can't fucking get it. I'm going to be driving. So they're all wanting to have a go. I said, no. But they all got in. We're driving around and around. When we finished and I got it right, I said, yo, I can drive now. We can fucking drive. And that's how I started driving cars. You know what I mean? Risen and all that, but that's another story because I was risen loads of cars in the end. But anyway, getting back to me tale, 1958, it was changing a lot for me then. I was getting older, more wide and more cleverer. And I started looking at all these shops where I had the big fair coats in. Mink shops, mink coats, jewellers. God, there's loads of them. And there was a road in Liverpool called Park Road. It was the biggest, one of the biggest roads in Liverpool. The shops were all full. It was full of shops in them days down there. Not like that now. Bowl Street was a posh shop. Oh, you know. All downtown, they were all posh shops, big posh things for the elite. You wouldn't believe that, would you, in Liverpool? So the next minute, Winnie's boyfriend, who was seen, he was telling me about my mates at Eddie, who at this game, they're doing smashing grabs. I said, what do you mean? You know, do a window and then a shop and all that. And Joey said, yeah, Charlie, that's fucking easy, you know. I said, but you need a motor with that. He said, ah, yeah, but we were doing them on foot. I said, ah, fuck that. Do it properly. Anyway, I started getting into it. And then I started weighing all the jewellery shops up and the fair shops and whatever it was. People were smashing windows in them days, early 60s, just to rob a fucking radio. You know what I mean? Or a record player or something like that, and run away. And I thought, well, why are you going to do that? You may as well fucking do something worthwhile. So anyway, I'm weighing all the shops up. And we come across this jewellery shop. Fucking never forget this as long as I live. And we get this car. Now, I've got a mate of mine with me, John O'Connor, and he was a fucking good kid, and he's dead now. He got killed in a car crash years ago. And I think it was round about that time, yeah. And anyway, he was doing them like, he was banging it with a fella called Cliffy Gill. Cliffy Gill and Wadey Gill. They were mates of mine from Eton. They were at, we were all at it. But they were rising up into the smashing. We were going higher and higher in the crimes. And it was escalating more, Liverpool, you know what I mean? So the next minute, gets this fucking car, 3.8 Jag, I picked. One of the fastest cars. This is when I'd been driving a little bit now, I've been doing the odd things and all that. But I wanted to do something, a real fucking jewellers, you know what I'm talking about. So I've got Joey with me, John and another fella, and we picked the right jewellers shop up, what we were doing. And it was a big long road what we were in. I said, look, again, the deterrent then was the police. They were on foot patrol. They'd have two coppers on one side and two coppers on the other side. No matter where you went to, after 12 o'clock in the night, coppers were there. You know what I mean? Till the next morning. Anyway, we fixed this road. And I've got this Jag. I've been driving by now, different cars, you know what I mean, other little cars. But this Jag was the fucking boss. No automatics then, it was gears, you know what I mean, sports. Oh, you know. Anyway, we goes down, clocks the place, looks at it. All right, we'll do it tomorrow night. You know, weighed it up, weighed the street up, which way we're going to go if there's a chase. Any police cars come. But what police cars could fucking catch us and that? Impossible. You know what I mean? They were all little fucking owl cars, what they had. So anyway, the next night we goes down there and we took with us a big shallow cardboard box, about 4 inches deep. That was for when you smash the window in. Use your gloves as well. Smash the window in. You're grabbing everything, some glasses going in. So anyway, so the next minute, Joey's the one what's going to get the jewellery. I'm going to be driving. John's going to be the lookout now. Fucking hell, this was a nightmare, this fucking thing, what an up. So when we got into the thing, went down the road. We went down the road first. Two coppers right down the bottom end of the road. About a mile, half a mile away. And the same road that way. And he said, oh, the busies are there. These fucking busies, they're everywhere. I said, I know, but we can have that fucking before the busies get us. I said, it's only going to take 2 fucking minutes to do that window then. There was no window shutters then, you know. No thingies that. We were the ones what everybody started putting window shutters because of our work, what we were doing. They started putting shutters on the windows. But this was before that. And there was the jewellery, all the fucking jewellery in the window. I said, we can have it right on the curbs. Gout. Fuck off, big bar over the window, boom. Joey's got the thingy. The glass is going in with the jewellery, the fucking lot. Well, like that, I'm in the car with like the revenue up, ready to get going. No, the way they say, you don't run away and don't scream away, and robbers don't scream away, and police chasing and all that. This fucking one did. What we had to do with this. So the next minute, I said, Joey, come on. You're getting a bit greedy. You haven't gone, there's this fucking other thing. I said, Joey, next minute, these coppers are running up, fucking here, on the way up to us. And one copper, they were fit, them coppers then. Fucking hell, they could run. Fit. Fella took his fucking helmet off, fucking stick out, whistling them out, blowing it and running at us. I said, Joey, come on, it's fucking on top. And anyway, he finally gets in the car, and as we're just pulling away, this copper runs in front of the car, couldn't kill him, couldn't run over him, could I? He goes, thinking I'm stopped, and I'm going to reverse, stop. No, what he done? He had like a musket on the front with Jaguar on it. He grabbed that, and I reversed, and he wouldn't leave go. And I reversed, and he's thinking, and the next minute, the other copper's running up, and he throws the fucking baton at the window. Oh, going out. I knew the other two were going to come up. Next minute, we're in a mess. So as I'm backing up like that, screaming the car, he's still on it. He won't fucking get off. So I started doing it, swerving like that, and in the end, he fucking get going. Then, fuck off, got off. Honest to God, it was a nightmare. But we come off best like we got it. So that's what we started doing, smashing grabs. And they were going all over, fucking everywhere, Liverpool. In the end, people started putting shutters on them. But we even combated that. We take something with us, like a piece of fucking thingy like that, stand-up piece of steel. And as the alarm went, the shutter would come down on the jewellery. Jab that in first, and it rolled it. You could get some of it, you know. That's what we were doing. Then we started doing the fair shops, you know what I mean, mink coats. Fucking not the mink coats. We had people, we had fences then, and I had fences what were buying everything off us. Just couldn't go fucking wrong with the work what we were doing. But that's sure what we done there. Fucking hell.
So at this point, I don't, police, are they like, are you becoming an enemy of the police?
Oh yeah, they're starting to, I'm starting to get, at this point, I'm starting to get a really reputation.
Because that cop, when he was hanging on, he must have seen your face, did he?
No. I mean, I would have been picked up, wouldn't I? Would have been identified. I think it was more interested in fucking saving his life in the end. Know what I mean?
Yeah.
No. We never went round with masks on them days. That comes at a later date in my stories, when we had to use them to go on armed robberies, what we were going to go on. But like, in them days, that's the way we do it. It's like primitive, but it was still working, and we were still getting. I was just doing things now, planning things out properly, where there was good escape routes, making sure everything was right, because we didn't want to come unstuck. And then, so like, me time was, I was getting young then, I was getting older then. I got into me, I was about 20. When I was about 20, I think, 18, 19, 20. That's when it started happening. The big stuff started coming in. But there was always the violence. And for some reason, I don't like saying this really, but I never wanted violence. I'm down as a fucking psychopath. They forgot me. Because people have been shot and killed. I'm down as, oh, what's that fella to do this and do that? Okay, I've been investigated for all kinds in the past. But there was a lot of violence going on, starting to come out. And I had to deal with it my way and no other way. The only way I knew how. If it meant me using a tool to do something, I'd have to do it. Know what I mean? But the people I had violence against, who I'd done it with, were only animals anyway, some of them. Scumbags, women beaters. You know, these fellas, they beating their wives up and beating the kids up and all that. Never done that in my life. Always treated a woman with respect. And another thing, you know, people say, oh, don't tell your beard. I've trusted women a lot, mate, in my life. I put my life on their hands, and I've trusted a woman more than a fucking man. The things they've done for me. They've stood in Crown Court for me and everything, and witnesses for me. Great women. And you know, a woman, you can't kid a woman. They can see right through you, mate. They know if you're at it with another beard. Tell you can't fool a woman. She can love you, but if she finds out you were another beard, she'll hate you. You know what I mean? That's your fault. Well, that's the way it was. But anyway, I was getting into all that sort of life now. That was all coming to me. And I met my first wife-to-be at that time. That's when it was starting off. And this is where it was going, where I come unstuck badly. And I went to jail.
So, Charlie, in part three, it's going to be 1963. Is it prison life? What can we expect?
I'm going to talk about prison life, what it was like. And I know people, I hate talking about prison life and prison politics because it's all doom and gloom. You know what I mean? Oh, I'm all innocent and all that. I'm talking about what it was like, what went on, the violence, what was in there was incredible. And don't forget, I'm the only man in prison in 1964 who gave the last man who got hung his meal before he went to court. But that's another story.
The last man story is incredible, and it's also in Charlie's books, of which there's about half a dozen, and the links for them are in the description box below this video. And if you want a signed copy in time for Christmas with a dedication in it, there's also a website link down there where you can contact the lady and she will coordinate that for you. You can also listen to some of the books on Audible, audiobooks, and ebooks. They're all available in ebooks worldwide, so check them out. Let us know in the comments what you thought. If you missed part one, I'll put the link for part one down there. If you've come over for part one, thank you. Such an outpouring of people, loving the history, loving the detail. Charlie's such a great storyteller, and he's just building it all up nicely, and we've not even got to the really big stuff yet. So stay tuned, folks. This series is going to be continuing. Have a great Christmas wherever you are in the world, and get the best Christmas gifts, Charlie's books. I'd start with Killer and Hyenas. That's what I started with. My parents loved them. Thanks, Charlie. Cheers.